Hello, everyone, and welcome to Masters of Digital Transformation, a podcast from AIM10X dedicated to uncovering the stories behind the world's leading change agents and the most valuable learnings from our community of global innovators. I'm your host, Caleb Masters, and as always, we're here to provide you with actionable insights from today's greatest thought leaders to guide and accelerate your journeys. In today's episode, we'll be joined by Robert Weltevreden, a former member of the Novartis Executive Committee as the Head of Customer and Technology Solutions. We'll start by talking about his career journey to becoming the Head of Technology at Novartis. We'll also cover the common hurdles to achieving a successful digital transformation and technology adoption before taking a look at how design thinking and Robert's pyramid of change can enhance the end user experience and enable a successful implementation. And then we'll close out the conversation by getting Robert's take on the importance of working with partners to ensure a successful implementation of your selected technology. But without further ado, let's get to learn a little bit more about today's guest, Robert Weltevreden. Robert has more than 30 years of experience in leadership positions at multinational organizations and a proven track record of driving successful business transformations in the life sciences industry. At Novartis and at Syngenta, he led full-stack business services and digital transformation teams with a significant impact on business results through operational excellence, disruptive digital transformation, and a strong talent pipeline. And part of his recipe for success was the belief in the value of integrated business services, where the respective functional domains work together in service of customer success. Robert, it's such a pleasure. Welcome to Masters of Digital Transformation.
Thank you, Caleb. Great to be here.
Well, hey, Robert, we're going to be talking a lot about a really important aspect of digital transformation that I don't know that we've covered adequately on this show, which is how to make sure it sticks. You make the plan, you execute the plan, but at the end of the day, how do you know this is actually sticking within the culture and within the processes? But before we get to that, I really want to get to know you a little better. Maybe our listeners aren't as familiar with your work. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about your career. What led you to a career in technology?
I would say it's probably a mix of serendipity and curiosity. I trained as a CFO, and my first many jobs were in the CFO field, in the finance field. When at Syngenta, we started to create this thing called business services. I got exposed to a broader variety of functions and activities, and I really wanted to just learn more and know more about tech. Because tech over the last 20, 30 years has just gone through a tremendous development. And it's been just going faster and faster. And that really drove my curiosity into the topic. So when I was fortunate enough to sort of expand my responsibility to cover tech, I was able to actually make it my job to get involved with technology and learn more about it and try to use technology to the benefit of the enterprise. So it's really, as with many things in career, it's what do you enjoy doing and are you at the right time at the right place? You know, that's really how it goes.
Well, it's certainly, as you said, technology has been the right place for innovators over these years. I mean, it's just exploded in the last 20 to 30 years, especially at the enterprise level. What would you say, given your rich experience at multiple organizations here, what would you say has probably been one of the biggest challenges that you've faced in your career?
As a business leader, the challenge that I think had to deal with most profoundly and most significantly was my own leadership. How to really become a much better leader than I was at the beginning of my career, where I might have been a smart individual, able to do a job pretty well, but that doesn't make you a good leader. And learning how to be a good leader is tough. It's tough. And it took me a few, let's say, concrete walls to slam into and to sort of learn to appreciate that as a good leader, you really need to be consciously and visibly developmental. You always need to look for a better version of yourself. And you need to be tremendously open for feedback to just keep growing, keep developing. Because your teams deserve you to be at your best. That thing called leadership is tough. It's really tough. It's the hardest thing to become good at. But I'm not saying I'm anywhere good at it at the moment. But I got better over the years. And that's been a challenge to get there.
Absolutely. Again, leadership is its own unique skill set. There's the technology side, highly technical, but when you're talking about leadership, it's really more of the people side of it. It's your temperament. It is having a vision. All those things, some people might have it somewhat intrinsically, but that has grown and developed just like any other skill set. Would you agree?
That's so true. So true. It's experience matters as well. I mean, you need to make mistakes, and you need to be owning up to those mistakes, and get better out of it.
Well, on that note, though, I mean, you've had a lot of successes and challenges, and maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what was one of your proudest achievements.
Across my career, the thing I'm most proud of is having been able to give young talents growth opportunities, giving them stretch assignments, allowing them to aim high, at the same time support them in their growth, support them when they fail, allow them to learn and grow. But seeing those young talents grow into managers and leaders in their own right, that's something that makes you proud. I mean, look, there's lots of stuff you do, right? I think seeing people grow, being able to contribute to that, that's really something you take on with you.
Yeah, very exciting. Building out teams and seeing those people move on to accomplish their own successes, is quite fulfilling. Because at the end of the day, a deal is a deal. Very important, essential to the business. But at the end of the day, those impacts, those people having on their own teams, sort of paying it forward approach.
That's right.
We already mentioned about how much tech has rapidly evolved. What would you say is the most exciting thing about the practical applications of today's digital technology, especially at the enterprise level?
I think it just got so much easier. When I started working, we had this thing called an AS/400 in the back of the office. I would say this old IBM machine, which spits out a lot of paper. That was right, real tech. That was, you need engineering skills to understand that machine, right? And then, of course, you moved on to the area of the ERP systems with the SAPs and the Oracles and the like. And they were complicated things, complicated pieces of software that required a lot of engineering savvy to make sense of them and to apply them into a business environment. Now, what I really enjoy seeing happening at the moment is that tech is becoming easier. It's really becoming easier. It's becoming more accessible. You have kids who are 8, 9, 10 years old behind their computer writing codes, right? I mean, that would not have been possible in the area of the SAPs and the Oracle. That's just an result. But now kids can do this stuff. It's more accessible, it's cheaper, it's faster. So therefore, the application of technology throughout companies, throughout society is just exploding at the moment. And that's really exciting. It's going so much faster.
With sort of that explosion and almost democratization of tech, what have you seen in terms of how technology, even at the enterprise, has become a lot more consumer or end user focused?
That's been one of the biggest benefits, I think, from this new tech wave, which is the user interface, the user experience is becoming front and center. Which again, indeed, the old estate, the old technologies we used to have, that just wasn't there, wasn't considered. The process needed to run, it needed to function, but the user interface wasn't that key. Now it is front and center. And that again, this just makes tech so much more accessible, so much more fun to use and to have at your disposal.
It not only makes the work more simpler, more straightforward, but it's more engaging.
Totally right. I mean, if you take one practical example, right, where you, as an individual, if you used to book a travel, in the past, you go to a travel agent and they would help you through that process. Now it's like 2-3 clicks and you're gone, right? You're on your way. It is just so much easier these days.
That's very exciting. Even though we've seen a lot of rapid evolution of tech, especially again in the world of the consumers, we're seeing that change as we just outlined a little bit within the enterprise. But there's still a lot of major hurdles that we're encountering in terms of actually getting this new tech implemented and adopted by the users within the enterprise. And as we start to think about today's topic, how to make a digital transformation stick, I wanted to get your take here. I mean, what have you seen as some of the biggest hurdles of achieving that successful digital transformation, specifically within the pharma industry?
I think the pharma industry is quite a unique industry. It's highly regulated. I know a lot of people don't appreciate it, but to be allowed to put a medicine into the market and have patients actually consume the medicine takes 10, 12, 14 years before you're actually allowed to do so. And most of that time is testing and verifications that you need to prove to the regulators that actually the medicine you're going to put in the market actually really, really works, which makes sense, right? I mean, you want to put stuff out that it really works. But that just drives through the entire industry, that regulation, that very specific sequencing of a process. drives through it, which means, for example, there's still a law of paper. In many countries across the world, if you want to file a new medicine to market, you come with like a stack of paper this thick to be able to do that. And that's just how that process still runs. And at the same time, different to other industries, as a pharma industry, actually, you're not allowed to freely interact with patients. You're not allowed to do it. My side straight, right? Because you're the one making the medicines. But actually, there's a crucial role for the physician in the middle. The physician is the person who speaks and interacts with the patient and who then determines which treatment, which medicine is right for him or her. And the pharma company is sort of held at arm's length for all the right reasons. But that, again, gives a very different twist to an industry because you don't have that fluid interaction with consumers that you have many other industries. If you're making data chips or if you're making iPhones, you're always in connection with the consumer. You get that consumer feedback. And that's another key difference. However, the core of the pharma industry really is the chemical and that's the core. That's really where most of the money is being spent on. And I must say, I've seen a tremendous adoption of tech in the R&D area. It's tremendous how, as we say, the research efforts are moving from in vitro to in silico, right? Where in the past, it was a lot of people in labs cooking and cooling and doing all kind of things with cells. Now you can simulate quite a bit of that in the computer. And that change has happened over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And it's tremendous. It's really tremendous. And it has the belief, it has the promise that it can truly accelerate the development of new medicines. And that will be the real revolution in the pharma industry.
That's very exciting. And especially as we think COVID, not too far in our rearview mirror at this point, the speed in finding these medicines is really essential at the end of the day. Because I think, as you put it, when we were talking before, you can't miss your deadlines. It's got to be on the shelf. It's life or death. You know, as we talk a little bit more about the hurdles here, I want to drill down. So according to a recent study from McKinsey, more than 70% of businesses that attempt digital transformations fail to achieve their original goals, in part due to the hurdles, some of the hurdles that you talked about specifically in the pharma industry. But there's a variety of other reasons that we're going to talk about today. Ensuring these large-scale digital transformations stick is really an immense challenge we're seeing across enterprises. And sometimes more conventional approaches to change really have failed to have that desired impact for many companies. So, Robert, I want to turn it back to you. I mean, what would you say are some of the costs of a failed attempt at new technology adoption, especially when we're thinking about deploying it company-wide?
I think there's three categories of costs to distinguish here. One is the fact that you spend money on a new tech investment and it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, that's just wasted money, money out of the door without a benefit. And that's easily quantifiable. Of course, that's what a lot of companies look at and focus on. So look, how's my investment budget being spent? That doesn't make sense. Second, though, if technology isn't adopted at the speed and at the pace that a company deserves, then you also miss a lot of opportunities. You miss opportunities in the face of your consumer. You miss opportunities in terms of improving your own internal operational excellence. The opportunity loss, sales growth, margin growth, whatever, is also quite significant of having a failed technology implementation event. And last but certainly not least, and maybe even more important, if a company is burdened by having too many tech implementation failures, then actually you're also not allowing the employees of that company to become more digital natives because you just keep them in the old ages, right? You keep them in the old ways of working. I think if there's one thing that companies and leaders really should think about these days is how do you take your teams and turn them into becoming digital natives? Because the emergence of Gen AI is going to change profoundly most of the jobs that we all have. And a leader at a company has a responsibility to expose their employees to that as soon as possible so that they can get used to what it means for them. And that, for me, is a really important cost of technology failure if you don't get to expose your employees to that, because then actually you make them less and less employable, which is not a good thing, right?
It's lost time, as you put it, in terms of competition, trying to keep up with your competitors, pharma industry. I mean, getting supplies on shelves, it's lost time there. You and I have talked about in the past how your approach has shifted over the last decade or so into more of a design thinking type role. I'd love to dig into that a little more to figure out exactly how can design thinking really make these digital transformations more effective and having more impact. So maybe you could elaborate here before we dive into that, though. How and why has your perspective on overcoming digital transformation hurdles that we already mentioned today evolved?
The tech implementations I've done over my career have been in the traditional waterfall approach, right? Because I've done a couple of big ERP implementations, and they follow waterfall because that's just how you do a big ERP, like an SAP or Oracle. It's not really advisable to do an ERP in a very fast, agile fashion. Not advisable. Significant chance of failure there. However, what I've seen, certainly in the last 5-6 years, is that these ERP systems have sort of retreated to become systems of records more so than systems of interaction, because there's been a tremendous, beautiful suite of much better solutions around those ERP systems that have become the systems of interaction that companies, employees, customers, suppliers are now working with. And these systems of interactions that are now emerging really, really benefit from the speed and the focus that design thinking allows, which means start with what the purpose is of a certain technology, start with what the user of that technology really expects to see and to get, and use that as the threat with which you can design those technologies, with which you can configure those technologies. And that sort of changing the whole tech landscape at the company level, with the systems records sort of retreating to that core ERP center, and the shell around it of much more agile, much more faster technologies, much more user-friendly technologies, I think is putting that design thinking really at the center of how you do things. And I've just seen that happening over the last 5-6 years. And whenever I supported teams to really fully embrace design thinking, the results were better. They were better.
When you're approaching it with the design thinking, you're really thinking about the user experience there and making what's already there more digestible, easily accessible. And like, as you say, providing a centralized source of truth or record of truth, I think, which is a real value add, especially as we think about how fast things are changing today. I want to dig into that a little more back on the consumer side. How has the rapidly evolving expectations of consumers really change the demand of enterprise technology to kind of meet that same approach?
Oh, one example I think we all will relate to in companies is the technologies that used to be used for HR processes, which back in the day were largely, if I may say, SAP driven, SAP SuccessFactors most recently. I think we've all sort of experienced those, and we've all been frustrated at times with how hard it is to get your admin and get your payroll to work through these technologies. And what's been, I think, really driven by the expectation of employees as consumers has been the emergence of a company like The Workday, which is a prime example of design thinking and has developed a technology that is as intuitive, as easy, as friendly as a consumer-grade technology, and which employees in companies really embrace. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to implement this a few times, and the difference is stark. And that shows you that, yes, the expectations are there, but you need to be able to match up to those expectations. And at the moment, not all areas of company processes are seeing a technology that is ready to respond to that sort of consumer-grade demand. It is not all there yet, but it's coming. It's coming.
Now, you and I have talked previously about your philosophy on design thinking, and a specific concept that you mentioned that I wanted to pick your brain about is this, what you call the pyramid of change. So could you describe a little bit your philosophy on using design thinking to lead human behavior through a quality end user experience, and maybe elaborate on how the pyramid of change fits into that?
Yeah, what I've learned is that any significant change in companies' ways of working or company strategy really only succeeds when there's a strong, united political will at the top of the organization. So, for example, as as an organization, if you say we want to be better in how we manage third-party spend, you can say, look, just tell the procurement team, get on with it, and up your game. Or if that procurement team actually doesn't have a codified procurement policy which describes the political will of the organization, the why you want the procurement organization really to step up, and which describes the new roles and responsibilities that correspond with that, which is the how, then the procurement team will most likely fail in that effort to manage third-party spend better. So having a clear set of business principles which give authority to the procurement team to be the single point of negotiation with suppliers and to explain what the role of the rest of the organization is in that, then you have a good chance. So at that top of the pyramid, I see the need for clearly described, defined political will and set of business principles or policies. With that, you can then describe how the organization needs to look and how business processes need to change, how that needs to be supported by a set of data principles. And once you have those business principles, a clear organization, clear process, clear data, then you can support that by the right technology investment at the bottom of that pyramid. And so it flows from political will down. And what I see too often is organizations that sort of start with, they've got a business problem, let's throw some technology at it and let's see if it sticks and if it's going to work. But if you haven't thought through all the other elements of what I call the pyramid of change, you will probably stumble in this. And that's for me the essence of how you sustainably, effectively embed significant change into an organization. You have to think through all those elements.
Right, absolutely. Because again, you can't look at technology as sort of a short-term fix, right? Otherwise, it's just a Band-Aid on a larger problem. It's not really a full transformation as much as it's more like plugging holes in the dam, so to speak, versus if you start at the top, that political will, you're talking about incorporating the technology into the culture, into the processes company-wide.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, again, what sort of outcomes have you seen from using this pyramid of change approach within your career?
A lot more sustainability, a lot more stickiness to the change. A much higher degree of success in ultimate tech implementations. And through that process, also a stronger sense of unity in the organization. If you consciously and deliberately address all these elements, you actually will have an organization that better understands what they're about, what they're doing, and who's doing what. And that's where business transformations, having the right sort of business transformation methodology really, really helps.
Certainly. And again, I just want to reiterate, it needs to come from the top, though. You need to have that buy-in from the executives to ensure that technology change is going to stick. Is that right?
Totally right. I mean, organizations are so savvy in smelling and seeing when there's not a united leadership. They totally see it. Leadership has to be vocal, walk the talk, and show visible buy-in and support for whatever change that you're getting through, combined with a solid dose of personal empathy, because whenever there's change in an organization, there's people that don't like the change, right? And that, because it impacts them personally. So leaders also need to show a tremendous amount of sympathy for them. But a united front absolutely helps.
In terms of trying to gain buy-in from the executives, how have you approached trying to pitch to the top, so to speak? What sort of experience have you seen, or any specific methodologies you've seen work in your favor?
I think one of the things I've sort of learned and I keep telling my teams as well is that you have to set and manage expectations when you embark on a certain change. There are so many connections within an organization, within a company, that you only really learn to appreciate through experience. And all those connections mean that if you make a change in one part of the organization, it ripples through. It always ripples through. And appreciating that and then proactively early on setting and managing expectations that something is happening and that people appreciate that this is coming. They know why, right? They know what's the intention. Doing that up front really, really helps.
Managing expectations, especially when you're speaking with leaders, very, very critical piece there. Now, of course, deploying tech at a company-wide scale, this is going to be no small feat, even with the proper buy-in and right-headed philosophies. I want to get your input and shift gears here. Talk a little bit more about the collaboration with the tech, with your partners who are trying to help solve these larger problems. What sorts of questions would you recommend our listeners ask to those prospective partners or vendors out there who are offering solutions to the business challenges they have?
First, always look for references. If you come across a tech company who's promising you A, B, and C, look for references. See if it's been done somewhere before. And this, of course, for companies that are already in sort of the beyond the start phase, right? There are companies that are running that are out there in the market. Look at experience from other companies, learn from that, and try to appreciate, does the tech really do what it promises? But also try to appreciate, how do you interact best with that company, right? So that's the first thing. Get those references going. Second, get the commercials out of the way early in the process. You don't want to burden the collaboration with all sort of commercial discussions all the time. Not helpful. It's just not helpful.
Yeah, I think those are all really, really great takeaways and good notes for folks who are actually diving into it now. Well, hey, Robert, before we close out, I have to ask a new question we've been implementing with our guests recently is getting on another recommendation. Say our listeners enjoyed the podcast and your thoughts and they want to learn a little more on this topic, how to make digital transformation stick. What book or article or maybe even talk or idea would you recommend to our listeners working to ensure that their technology investments are sticking within their company?
There's actually a really good book that just came out like a month ago from my good friend, Tony Saldana, who's an ex-P&G business service leader. He wrote together with Filippo Passerani, who was the CIO of P&G, a book called Revolutionizing Business Operations. And this gives a very good view based on many years of experience in how to implement change in organizations, business process change, tech change, how to do that, how to do it well. Really recommend Revolutionizing Business Operations from Tony Saldana.
Excellent recommendation, listeners. We'll make sure to list that in the show notes today. Fun fact for listeners who are tuning in for the first time, but Tony Saldana did host this program for 2 years. So we have to give tip the hat and shout out. He's still teaching us new lessons every day. Well, hey, Robert, is there any other parting words or closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners regarding how to make transformation stick?
Aim high, be bold, don't be scared for the risk of failure. However, manage those expectations. Make sure that you've got the sponsorship on your side from the key stakeholders, but aim high, be bold.
Robert Welter-Vreden, thank you so much for joining us on Masters of Digital Transformation today.
My pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to today's episode featuring Robert Welter-Vreden. To keep up with more episodes of Masters of Digital Transformation, please head on over to your preferred podcast app, give us a follow and a subscribe, and leave us a rating and a review if you enjoyed the show, most specifically on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can learn more about the activities and learning opportunities available through AIM10X by following O9 Solutions on LinkedIn. As we close out today's conversation about how to make digital transformations stick, I'd like to leave you with this thought about follow-through from the best-selling author Zig Ziglar when he said, "It was character that got us out of bed, commitment that moved us into action, and discipline that enabled us to follow through." Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. In our next episode, I'll be sitting down with the former chief digital officer at Linksys and an investor, Jörg Hellwig, to talk about why it's so important and vital for suppliers to be collaborating in today's increasingly volatile supply chains. You won't want to miss it. We'll catch you again next time.